Game On 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
Hello, you're welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to talk to Kenny Cunningham live at Celtic Park in a few minutes' time. Dennis Hurley on the goings-on at the Cork County Board meeting last night. We have Johnny Sexton on Leinster and Ireland. Reggie Corrigan as well on the appointment of Leo Cullen. And Andrew McNamara and Patrick Mullins will be joining us in studio, I should say, a little bit later on to discuss all things racing. Alan Cawley is with me. How are you, sir?
Good, Hugh. Yourself?
I'm okay. We got some pretty shocking news earlier on today. A former colleague of mine, in fact my first ever sports editor, Johnny Lyons, passed away today. Pretty shocking news, to be honest. You know, he was a young enough guy, completely out of the blue, and I suppose had a bit of time to think about him. He gave me my first ever job in sports broadcasting in 98FM. He was editor at the time, and I was kind of going through, shall we say, an early life crisis. Wasn't sure exactly which way the career was going. And yeah, I walked in for an interview with Johnny pretty much off the street, having no experience, and sat down. We did an interview, and the interview went something like this. He said, who does Michael Owen play for? And I said, Liverpool, which he did at the time. Yeah, okay, great. He says, what do you like to drink? I said, what do you mean, Johnny? He says, if you're out for a few pints, like, what would you have? I said, well, Heineken or Guinness, you know. He says, super, when can you start? I said, is that it? He said, yeah, yeah, nice. It's a great voice. I can hear it there. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Michael Owen, Liverpool, that takes that box. No problem. So, yeah, that was that. Started a career at 98FM. Johnny was my boss for a good few years. And I suppose for that, I will be eternally grateful. I mean, there are a lot of stories I could tell you, most of which are unsuitable for broadcasting on radio. But he was probably the biggest Dutch football fan that I've ever met in my life.
Football fan.
Yeah, and particularly Ajax. And I reckon he could run rings around most of the local Ajax supporters in terms of his knowledge of Dutch football. Unbelievable fan of the Netherlands.
He interviewed me a couple of times, Johnny. He was a great character because he was a big Leeds man. So a couple of times I might have been home or around the time I was at Leeds. But even recently, like the League of Ireland stuff, he'd be on. But such a character, yeah. He was, even with the last Ireland match, he was doing stuff for Aviva, and he was in the room asking us the questions, the usual. And Johnny, larger than life character. But even just going back to yourself, you always remember the person who gives you your first kind of break, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you'll never forget that, like, you know.
And Johnny did have this reputation as being a bit mad, you know, and he was. Like, he was great crack with a few drinks in him. And, you know, he was a bit of a special character in lots of different ways, but he was always brilliant to me. And I mean, so fair and everything that happened. He used to, every time I walk in the door, because basically his shift would end and mine would start, and he'd say, "You burnt the curse!" like this. And I always knew everything was all right when Johnny said that. And any time I did walk in the door and he just said, "Hugh, how are you?" I knew there was trouble coming. Yeah. I'd done something wrong.
Okay.
But, you know, as a boss, he was brilliant. As a broadcaster, he had his own unique style. He never used to eat anything during his entire working shift. So he'd be in there at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he wouldn't leave till 2, and he would never eat anything because he believed that it interfered with his voice.
Really?
Yeah. Incredible stuff.
That's an interesting one now.
And if you ever said, some of the sales staff used to sit down the end of the building, which was beside the toilets, right? And they always used to hear Johnny warming up in the morning with his vocal cords. He'd be in kind of clearing his throat and making sure everything was crisp and fresh, as he used to say. And
I'd hate to see him performing in front of 40,000 if that was the case.
Mad into his rock music. We were all convinced he was going to go and get a job with Phantom FM one day.
He was a rocker,
yeah. Rocker, yeah. Like the leather trousers as well.
Yeah, he loved the leather
Not
trousers.
Not many people can pull off leather trousers.
The only other person I know who could pull off the leather trousers apart from Johnny was Johnny Logan.
Johnny Logan, yeah.
And they're the only two I've ever seen wearing leather trousers regularly.
Yeah, he was a big fan of the rock music, all right, Metallica and, you know, AC/DC and all that kind of stuff. But sport and music,
sport
his
man.
First loves. And he had an encyclopedic knowledge. And you know what? He was a pretty great guy, I have to say. And Johnny, we're going to miss you. Rest in peace, old pal. Okay, we're going to go and talk to Kenny Cunningham. We did this a little bit earlier on in the show, in fact, and he is at Celtic Park ahead of tonight's Champions League first leg playoff between Celtic and Malmo. I first asked him if he was looking forward to the match.
So, yeah, big night for the football club. Not just the football club, I think, probably Scottish football as a whole. It'd be great to have a Scottish representative in the Champions League group stages, and you know Celtic have a realistic chance of doing that. Not just this evening, obviously it's over two legs, but listening to the manager speaking in the press today, he's quietly confident. He trusts his players, And clearly believes they have a more than a fighting chance of getting through over the two legs.
Yeah, because last night we spoke of the pressure on Louis van Gaal and Manchester United to get to that group stage. Is there that same kind of pressure on Ronnie Dyla, do you think?
To a certain extent. Obviously, he was relatively new into the job this stage last season. So when they came unstuck against Maribor, maybe people, yeah, rightly so, would have said, look, he's just new into the football club. It's going to take him time, you know, to... you know, mould the team in the way that he wants, you know, impose his character, his style of play. So this is a year down the road now, so maybe that excuse maybe doesn't stand up. Mm. So it is a challenge for not only for the players, but for the manager himself, kind of tactically how he sets his team out over the two legs. I think the two managers are very familiar with each other, have a good personal relationship, you know, keen knowledge of both teams, how each individual manager likes to set up and play. So, you know, it's set up for a very evenly contested match over the two legs.
And when you think back to that Maribor defeat this time last year, I mean, there was pressure on Dyla and, you know, even speculation from a few sources over in Glasgow that they wondered what he would actually last the season. And obviously, a year, a lot has changed since then. And you'd imagine, you know, he does know an awful lot about his team in that interviewing period.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, I never felt he was in danger of losing his job before the end of the season. If you make that type of appointment, a relatively young manager, you know, you have to back him, you know, through the good and bad. And they've done that and they've been rewarded to a certain extent. Obviously, the league last season and the Scottish League Cup as well was a great end to the season. And it looks as if Dyla kind of grew into the role as the season went on, became more comfortable in his surroundings. And, yeah, I think himself and the club in general are in a far better position to push for that Champions League inclusion this time around. Man will be a stiff test of good pedigree and some good players, but I don't think anything really for Celtic to fear.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you then, how much do you know about Malmo? I mean, on paper, you'd say Celtic are a lot stronger right across the park. But I suppose, you know, they got to get a result here, Kenny. They don't want to be going there, you know, with any kind of pressure, albeit in a draw situation or even conceding a couple of goals.
Yeah. I wouldn't say clearly Celtic would disagree in terms of Celtic being stronger all over the park. There's still some quality throughout this Swedish team, sprinkling of Swedish internationals. Bit of luck on a Celtic's favour tonight, probably two of the most prominent players absent. Through suspension, Marcus Rosenborg, top scorer this season, he's missing. Kofi Adu, like a prominent player in midfield, not available either. So, you know, these games can be decided by small margins. So missing those two players this evening can only help Celtic. They just have to make sure they take advantage of it and ideally take a lead into the second leg next week.
Did you see any of Manchester United last night, by any chance?
I didn't know. No, I haven't paid my subscription yet to be able to to view. I'm getting torn both ways. It's going BT at the moment. They're killing me. So no, I didn't see the game last night. Obviously, I read a few of the reports, etc.
Okay, no sweat. All right. So, you have team news for us, I believe. Celtic have named their starting 11.
Yeah, they have indeed. You know, no huge surprise. It's a reasonably strong back for Lustig, Van Dijk, Boyata, and is Aguera, midfield forward of Armstrong, Brown, Bitten, Forrest, and Johansson. Looks like he's going to play just off Lee Griffiths up front, so I don't think there's too many surprises there. A couple of players available to the manager, Chris Commons, I think shook off an injury. He may have been in the manager's thoughts, but the fact he's been out through injury, maybe he might be utilised from the bench this evening. But it's got a pretty solid look to it, the Celtic team. I mean, they've had a solid start to the season. A little bit worrying, kind of. They've leaked a few goals in the last couple of games, particularly the last game, 4-0 up against the Inverness, conceding kind of two late goals. No, it doesn't sound an awful lot. So what? The game was over 4-0, but you know, it just gives you a little bit of a sense on knees, maybe a little bit of slackness, kind of lack of concentration in kind of defensive areas. And speaking to one or two people today, just sense if there's any kind of maybe fragility in this Celtic team, it's maybe just on the defensive side, like, you know. So they'll have to be solid this evening. Concentration levels will have to be good at this stage in European competition. You just can't afford to switch off, particularly in defensive situations. Your concentration has got to be, you've got to be totally focused for the whole of the 90 minutes. So big responsibility on the shoulders of that back four unit and goalkeeper. And in particular, I think Virgil van Dijk, a lot of talk of him in the newspapers the past 12 to 18 months, it seems, almost, but in particular the last couple of weeks, it seems as if his departure from this football club, it looks as if it's imminent. So important, not easy for him to keep his focus tonight and his concentration, put all those matters to one side and and focus on the game tonight. But that's what he needs to do, because Celtic need him to be at his best.
Okay, you can listen to Kenny Cunningham and George Hamilton as part of the commentary team on RT Television. 7:45 kick-off tonight. You might get 10 minutes late if the viewers stick with it for the end of the show. But Kenny, thanks a million. Enjoy the match.
No bother.
Cheers. Kenny Cunningham there. Yeah, I mean, do you care if Celtic make the Champions League or not?
Honest answer.
Honest answer.
I couldn't care less.
I could not care less.
I honestly, Celtic, look.
But yeah, they're our team, Alan.
They're not our
team.
They're
an Irish team.
They're not.
They're an Irish team in Glasgow. They're the Irish team in Glasgow.
Is my team, you.
They're a Catholic team in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Do you not feel the connection?
Oh, I can feel it, yeah. I can feel it every Saturday at 3 o'clock. I feel it when we're playing.
I don't understand this obsession that a lot of people in Ireland have with Celtic.
Look, if people want to support them, good luck to them, and whatever they feel the links is there, grand. But
be more of a Rangers man myself. No, I'm joking.
The question you asked, no. If they get through, good luck to them. If they don't, I won't be losing any sleep tonight.
No, who cares?
And if a tricky tie, Malmo will be decent.
51552 if you care about Celtic progressing to the Champions League. Dennis Hurley, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. You, cheers.
Good to talk to you. Listen, you were in your journalist capacity, you were down at the Cork County Board meeting last night. Look, I suppose the primary focus was to find that committee, to find the successor to Brian Cuthbert, but I suppose it descended a little bit into farce at times, did it?
I suppose it's probably a bit too strong to say it descended into farce, but it was the first meeting since early July, and I suppose in the interim, the two Cork senior teams had exited their championships fairly meekly, and obviously in the wake of the statement after Brian Cuthbert's departure, a lot of delegates had things to get off their chest, and a lot of them took the opportunity to do so.
Yeah. What kind of stuff was said?
Well, I suppose there were two main targets, really, from the delegates. Half of them who spoke, I suppose, were unhappy with the executive of the board for the statement. There was very strong language, in fairness. Now, they weren't afraid to stand up to the executive. One delegate said it was an appalling blunder, and that it was deplorable. And another one said it was like something out of Father Ted. And then, as well, I suppose a few delegates were unhappy with the way they'd been portrayed by Donal Cusack on the Sunday game, the night of the hurling loss, and the way that he had called them stooges and yes men, and a lot of them took the opportunity to refute those remarks too. One delegate had actually said that he had gone to the trouble of contacting the Sunday game to put his complaints on record, and a few of them were unhappy that Cusack had said what he said, first of all, and then that Des Cahill had allowed him the forum to say that.
Yeah.
There was one delegate who said that it was the first analyst in the history of the Sunday game to turn in his county, which was probably a bit of an exaggeration, but it was, I suppose, it was in keeping with the general theme of the comments.
So is there a lot of anger at Donal O'Loughlin then in Cork? I mean, even if you take delegates as a given, maybe, and those who might have felt they were particularly the source of his ire, if you like, when he made that appearance in the Sunday game, what is generally the perception of what he said? Are there more people that disagree with him than agree with him?
I'd say in keeping with the true Cork spirit of kind of the way it was with Roy Keane, I suppose half are with him and half are against him, and the two factions are probably only getting further and further away from each other. Like, a lot of what he said on the night did make perfect sense, of course, but I suppose the delegates being one of his targets that night, you know, they heard the insult, and then they kind of, once you hear that, you don't hear anything else beyond it, even though there is a lot of positive to be taken from it. So I suppose they're naturally going to be predisposed against him. And then I suppose a lot of the people who are for him probably aren't in a position to kind of influence that at county board level, not at the moment anyway, I suppose.
What did the board itself feel about the delegates expressing their anger? What was their kind of comeback? Did they try and refute the suggestions that it was all a bit Father Ted and a bit embarrassing and a bit over the top, or did they say much at all?
Well, I suppose in fairness to Chairman Jarlane, he read out an apology early enough in the meeting after there was reports that had been read out from the inter-county management set regarding their games, and Jarlane, he read a statement after that apologising basically for giving the inference that the board were critical of Padraig Hughes, who refereed the drama of the final. Mm-hmm. So he read that out first, and then I suppose that maybe it took a bit of wind out of the sail of some of the delegates who were ready to have a real cut. And after they had vented their spleen, Jorlane again just held his hands up and said, as the chairman, he took responsibility on behalf of the executive that it was a mistake, or sorry, not that it was a mistake, but that the apology had been issued, and that it was time to look forward and focus on improving things in the future.
So we have three former All-Ireland winners, if I'm not mistaken, Nicholas Murphy, John O'Driscoll and John Coleman, who are going to join Frank Murphy and Jorlane in the search for the successor to Brian Cuthbert. Has that been met with a kind of a positive response? And is there anybody that stands out straight away as somebody that they might go and talk to?
Well, I suppose there has been a generally positive response, all right, in that the three guys chosen, John Coleman, John O'Driscoll and Nicholas Murphy, they have all won All-Ireland for Cork, and I don't think any of the three of them would be easily influenced if anybody was trying to push them in a given way. I think they're all their own men, and they should have something positive to contribute. In Cork, there's probably a feeling that John Cleary is the standout candidate because he has worked with so many of the squad at under-21 level. He was selector, and then he was manager, and he had a great record with the under-21s. Mm. And they won All Ireland in 2009, and he would be widely seen as the favourite. He went for it in 2013 with Brian Cuthbert, and it came down to the final two between him and Brian, and Brian got the nod. And I suppose there was, his supporters at the time would have been disappointed that he didn't get it, and there might be a fear that he mightn't want it this time around. But I'd imagine he would be one of the first people that the committee will talk to see if he is interested, and I think if he is, it would be hard to see anybody getting it ahead of him.
Okay.
A couple of weeks ago, Larry Tompkins was asked about his thoughts on it, and he said he felt that it was important to have someone with All-Ireland winning experience as part of the management team. So I suppose straight off you're kind of narrowing it down to members of the 89 and 90 teams, or else members of the 2010 team. I suppose it's probably too soon for any of them to be getting involved, so he'd clearly be in favour of someone from his own vintage, and John Cleary obviously would fall into that bracket if he was on those panels.
But it'll definitely be a Cork man.
I would be very, very surprised if it wasn't a Cork man. I think the closest suggestion was that it was made that it mightn't be a Cork man was that it would be Peter Creedon, who is originally from Cork, but was in the Tipperary for the last while. But he ruled himself out, saying that he didn't have the time to give to the TIFF job, and he definitely wouldn't have time to give it to Cork. So I really would be very surprised if it wasn't the Cork man in charge.
Okay, listen, Dennis, thanks a million. We're just out of time, unfortunately, but I appreciate you coming on. Thanks a lot.
Okay, cheers to you. Thanks.
Thanks a million. Dennis Hurley there. You can read his stuff in The Examiner, among other newspapers. And interesting just to see the reaction. I never asked you your reaction on Manchester United last night. I presume you watched it.
I thought they were good, Hugh. I watched it, yeah.
Sloppy start.
Yeah, well, the goal was unlucky. The OG, like, now in fairness, Yanezai didn't cover himself in glory, turning his back. He could have easily stood up and let the ball hit him.
But I'd say Van Gaal was a nervous man, though, when that
You've seen his reaction when it went in. But I think they played well. In fairness to Memphis and a few of the newer lads, Darmian as well, I thought was very good, the fullback. And it's only early days. I know they haven't played well, people have suggested, in the couple of games in the league, especially against Spurs. But they've still got 6 points, and they're building towards something, Hugh, and they have a brilliant defensive record. So it's the thing I took out of it last night, looking at it, it's the first time, in especially since Gary Neville was rightful, and even going back as nearly, I know Evra was quite good. Yeah, Evra was very good for them, in fairness. I was nearly going to say Dennis Oram back since then. But it's the first time that they looked of two quality fullbacks in Luke Shaw and Darmian. I'd still be a bit worried about them, even though Smalling has made a good start. But I'd still be a bit worried about them centre-half. But from there on up, I'm well happy with the forward line. But they just need someone up front as well as centre-forward. But in terms of the midfielders, the sign, Schneiderlin's very good. Schweinsteiger as well, if he can stay fit. Just gives them that kind of calm assurance in midfield with Carrick. So, and then Memphis looks very good.
Yeah, what about Wayne Rooney, though? I mean,
he was a bit better last night. I think people are getting carried away with a couple of bad games.
Are they, yeah?
I think so.
I haven't seen a huge amount of him, I have to say, because I wasn't around last weekend.
Yeah, look, and I think it was more, rather than Rooney being poor, I think it was more a reflection on the team weren't kind of playing all out attack kind of football in the first couple of games, so he was sacrificed for, because obviously he was up front and wasn't maybe getting the chances or getting an awful lot of ball. He was much more involved last night. I thought he was better.
What about Memphis?
Rooney's unreal.
Yeah,
he is. Rooney's been a phenomenal player. Two games and now people getting carried away, I wouldn't read too much into that. Memphis looks very good. Like him, really like him.
Likes, I know, to be called just Memphis, not Memphis Depay, apparently. He doesn't want his
over
fathers.
His dad, yeah.
Yeah.
It is interesting, yeah, but I like him, yeah. He's very sharp. Bit of end pro. I've seen someone comparing him to Nani, but I think he's a far better player than Nani. Mm. He's a bit more about him. He's more end product. I know he got two great goals, but just in general play as well, I thought he was very good.
Okay, questions for Andrew McNamara or Patrick Mullins, do let us know, because the lads are going to be joining us in studio in a few minutes' time. But we're going to take a quick break, and we've got Johnny Sexton coming up after these.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
Now, Ireland at half, Jonathan Sexton was at Dublin Airport today to encourage Irish rugby fans to make the smart choice and fly with Aer Lingus as they travel and support the Irish team at the World Cup. I'm delighted to say that Johnny is on the line with us now. Listen, thanks for taking the call, Johnny.
No problem. Pleasure.
How's the form at the moment? I imagine you're kind of looking forward to getting back onto the pitch over the next couple of weeks and playing some games.
Yeah, definitely. I've been itching to get back playing games. I think when the plan was made around, I suppose individually, guys had a plan going into pre-season. I thought it was a good idea to have a longer one with the, you know, talking to the coaches and the fitness staff, because I hadn't had a pre-season in a couple of years. But I think I was sort of itching to get back on the pitch when I was watching the boys playing against Wales and Scotland, and hopefully I'll get a chance now in the next couple of weeks to play.
Yeah, because as you say, I mean, it was different for you last year with Racing, and I'm just wondering how you feel physically and fitness-wise at the moment, having had that few weeks under your belt. I mean, do you feel like a different guy than, say, you were 12 months or even 2 years ago?
Yeah, I hope so. Like you said, I haven't really had a pre-season since the year before the Lions Tour, you know, because I went straight from the Lions Tour to Paris and spent 2 years there and not having sort of a block. You know, serious training under my belt in the summertime to build into a season. So it's been great from that point of view to be home and to be doing some, you know, really great training to get ready for the season ahead, and hopefully that hard work will stand to me coming into these games.
Has it been tough? I mean, was it difficult, the pre-season stuff? I know nobody likes that, but how did you find it?
Yeah, it always is tough physically, but it's probably my favourite time of year in terms of, you know, you go out, you train hard, and then you get to the weekend, Friday afternoon, you're off, and you're off Saturday and Sunday. So, and you've no pressures, you've no worries with regards to matches and things like that. So it's not that tough a time mentally. It's just the physical toll it can take on you when they're flogging you week in, week out.
Yeah, I imagine. Maybe J4 pre-season training doesn't quite cut the old international standard. But what's it like for, I suppose, being back, you know, first of all, being back at home, and also back on working under Joe? Obviously, you know all about that with your time at Leinster.
Yeah, I've worked obviously with Joe for 5 seasons now, so not a lot has changed. It still is intense and intense as ever. It's been great. It's how well I look at like that. I think it's when you're on the pitch, it's all work. When you're in meetings, it's all work. And then when you're off, you're off. And you know, I much prefer it that way. I think it prepares us really well for the international matches ahead, because they are really intense. The pressure you're under, and not just from expectations from the world, but also from the pitch, you're playing against, you know, the best of the best, and you need to be on top form. So it's been great preparation so far.
And for the other guys as well, who I know obviously their time with Joe during the Six Nations and stuff, but I think you only get a couple of weeks really before the first match then, and this is a kind of a block of a few weeks where guys who mightn't be as used to them as a few of the Leinster guys get a chance to see how it all works.
Yeah, exactly, and hopefully we'll be better off for all that preparation. Hopefully we'll see, you know, more fluid Ireland and you know, better combinations that we've worked together all summer, and we'll have hopefully 4 games under our belt, 4 international games, you know, leading into the World Cup, and hopefully see the best of us now, you know, over the coming months.
In terms of leaving France and being back at home, I mean, was it a pretty easy decision for you once all the details and everything had been sorted out back home that this was just a natural fit for you to come back?
Yeah, well, I think the decision was made so long ago. It was made last summer, you know, before my second season in Paris. And, Yeah, look, I think from my point of view with Ireland and there was many reasons I wanted to come back to Leinster as well, but the one of the biggest factors was just international rugby and that travel in between games, playing for us in between Six Nations games and having to travel back, and you know, some of the arguments between medical staff and whether I was fit for certain matches or not. You know, I'm not going to miss any of that stuff, but you know, I will miss certain things about Paris. I'll miss the certain place in the city and certain people, and you know, my wife, there's a lot of things as well, but we're delighted to be home, and it's I suppose it's where where I've always wanted to be, with, you know, playing for Leinster and being, you know, looked after under the IRFU. I made no secret of that I would have preferred to be here.
Is it something then that you would advise other guys to do if they came seeking your advice, that, you know, if the opportunity was right, that a move abroad is actually can be a good experience?
Yeah, it is. It's a great experience, and I did. I enjoyed it massively. But with that, there was a few frustrations, more around the rugby side of things. But I think the way Paul is doing it is probably ideal, in terms of he'll finish up with Ireland, and then he can go over to France, focus fully on Toulon, and he'll have blocks of time where he's going to be off. He won't have to travel back for Six Nations games. He won't have to worry about, you know, if he's going to be fit enough for certain games, or, you know, the intensity that goes with international rugby is a lot different to the top 14. So, look, I think the way he's doing it is ideal, and I think a lot of players might sort of follow suit there.
Poor old Rog must be lonely enough, though, without you to call him over there at the moment.
I don't know, you'd have to ask him, but no, we're missing each other, but look, he's there for another year, and I think his idea would be to come home and to coach somewhere in Ireland, and hopefully they can get him back in the system sooner rather than later.
Leo Cullen, Johnny, was confirmed obviously as Leinster coach today. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, it's great news. You know, it obviously has been rumoured for the last few weeks that he was going to take over, so we've been sort of waiting the announcement, but I think it's a great decision. I think that no one knows the place better than he does, and you know, he's been such a great captain for Leinster over the years, and then to step into forwards coach, you know, he obviously had that season to learn from, and now he's the head man, and I think he'll do a fantastic job, and from what I've heard, he's started off in great fashion so far.
And all the players seem to back that up, and his familiarity and the respect that everybody seems to have for him is a brilliant thing. But also, I suppose, you know, listening to you over the years and guys like Brian O'Driscoll, Rob Kearney, I mean, one kind of constant theme for me that I've always taken from you guys in your training is this importance of bettering yourselves as players and learning new things. And I'm just kind of wondering, because you guys know Leo so well and because he's been involved with Leinster for so long, is that something that maybe you might question whether you can learn a huge amount about somebody that you know so well?
Yeah, well, that obviously is something that you know, we leave up to the guys above us to decide. But yeah, there isn't a certain positive with someone new coming into an environment and you know, bringing new ideas and makes guys, you know, excited about going to training. And you know, Leo spent a few weeks in New Zealand before he took over as forwards coach, and I'm sure he's learned a lot there that he was holding back on because he wasn't the head man, and hopefully he'll bring a few of those ideas forward now. It's something new that we haven't seen before, and you know, there's still scope for someone new to come into the environment, you know, underneath Leo, and maybe that'll happen going forward.
Yeah, and Kurt McCulkin as well, you know, to have him back, he's been, was so much a part of, I suppose, the first Heineken Cup win as well, and then the guys like Eason Athey and yourself, all of a sudden it seems like a much more positive camp than, say, versus last year.
Yeah, it's very hard for us for me especially, to speak about last year because I wasn't part of the environment, but yeah, I think, look, I can only speak positively about guys like Kurt, who, you know, played a huge part in turning Leinster from nearly men to winning a big trophy, and guys like Issa, who was, you know, you put in, you know, a lot of players that have played with him would say he's the best player they've ever played with, and you know, when guys like that come back into the environment, they can only be positive. And the type of person he is as well, he leads by example, he does everything right, the younger guys can look at him and have someone to aspire to.
Okay, so looking ahead to the World Cup, I mean, I was lucky enough to be in New Zealand 4 years ago and following the team around, and you know, it must be a very different experience for you because, you know, you're undisputedly the number one fly half, and you're, you know, obviously with the pool that's to come with France and everything like that, you just must be looking forward to, I suppose, approaching it in a different way, Johnny, than versus 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think, yeah, exactly. I think 4 years ago I was in a different place, probably a bit uncertain, especially in the green jersey, about you know, what was expected, and you know, whether I was, you know, the man to be trusted from, you know, I was in and out so much. But look, myself, Paddy and Mads will have great battle for the jersey now going forward, but like I said, I'm a lot more comfortable with knowing what's expected of me and what I need to sort of do to get in the team week in, week out, and to improve the team going forward.
And without putting words in your mouth, you're in it to win it.
Well, we're in it to win the first game, definitely. That's the mantra. We're in it to, I think we haven't looked too far past the warm-up tests. You know, if I haven't played a match yet, so I can't really talk about winning World Cups. You got to build some form, you got to build some fitness through the games that are coming up, and you know, come the World Cup, then we can answer questions about if we're capable of winning or not.
Okay, well look, it's been brilliant to talk to you. We wish you, the whole country wishes you all the best in the World Cup. Thanks many for your time, Johnny.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Reggie Corrigan joins us on the line now. Reggie, just apropos of what we were speaking about with Johnny there and Leo Cullen's appointment today at Leinster, it's a surprising one for a few different reasons. What's your reaction to it?
Yeah, I suppose you could say it's surprising in that Leo probably wouldn't be an experienced head coach, and for a franchise as big as Leinster, people might think that, you know, it is surprising that he's been given such a huge level of responsibility. But to be honest with you, I felt that it was in the pipeline for some time. I thought that they were going to go with Leo simply because, you know, he's someone who's been around the environment for a long time, knows the system very well, knows the players very well. And what people probably don't know is that Leo has been sort of groomed for this in a way, in that even when he was playing, he was very much involved with the coaching staff during Michael Cech and John O'Gibbs' days, and he was contributing a lot to the coaching that was going on at the time. So there's probably a lot more experience there than people would give Leo credit for. So I think I have to say that I'd admire Leinster for making a decision like this. They've always been known for taking a bit of a gamble when it comes to coaches. Michael Cech, for one, Joe Schmidt, you know, was an assistant coach before he came to Leinster. And Matt O'Connor also was a not renowned head coach. So they do tend to think a little bit outside the box in that. And overall, looking at it as it stands, I think it's probably a good decision.
Yet there are a lot of Leinster fans at the moment, just by judging from the reactions that I've read so far today, that would make the case that this is Leinster settling for Leo Cullen, that, you know, when Matt O'Connor was told that his contract would not be kept on, that there wasn't really a plan in place, and that Leo Cullen is someone that they just had to settle for rather than going out and getting what would be their prime target, if you like.
I don't know if settling would be the right word. I would agree that I don't think a lot of thought or planning went into a replacement for Matt O'Connor. It seemed at the time to be a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction. A lot of people were surprised that there wasn't somebody lined up ready to go if they were going to make such a big decision to get rid of a coach during his tenure and all that entails. So I think you can understand why Leinster fans would have that opinion. But at the same time, when you look at the bigger picture, a new coach coming in, whoever that might be, has to take some time to bed in anyway, and they've got to get to know the place that they're in. A foreign coach coming in wouldn't necessarily know the players, the systems, and the setup that's there in Leinster. So they would take some time to settle into that role too. So I think Leinster made the decision that not so much settling for Leo, but more, you know, they know what he's about, and they know that he can slot in seamlessly into the system, and also that he has the respect of the players, and I think ultimately that's the most important thing.
And Johnny Sexton did say that, and the players that have been asked about it so far, Sean O'Brien included, Devon Toner, all echo that they have a huge amount of respect for him, that they're very positive about it. Yet, you know, Reggie, I think, you know, think back to when you were playing, and I think this is true of a lot of the guys in the squad at the moment. They demand, to you know, standards of the coaches, that they better themselves and learn new stuff on the rugby training ground every day. And I'm just wondering, you know, what new skills can Leo Cullen bring to a setup that he has been part of for such a long time now?
Yeah, well, you see, that's the very point, Hugh, is that Leo would have been one of those players leading the charge in demanding higher standards from coaches and that the players are bettering themselves. So he's very aware of that. So, I mean, he's not going to take this role on unless he feels that he can improve what is there already and bring something better to the players and improve them as players. So I think that he would have given this serious consideration himself before he decided to take on such a mammoth task as leading one of the top franchises in Europe. And he obviously feels that he can bring something to the table. And given what I've experienced when I was there and he was working alongside the likes of John O'Gibbs and Kurt McQuilkin, who again is now back involved and is going to be an integral part to what Leinster are trying to do, I think that he will have taken that into account, and he obviously feels he can bring something along those lines, and so do Leinster, and I think people probably need to respect that.
Yeah, and for Leo, this is not without its risks. As you said, he must have given it serious consideration because it's a two-year contract, and for somebody who's just starting his coaching career, head coaching career, Reggie, you know, if this one should go badly, and obviously, look, I'm not suggesting that it will, but if it doesn't work out, you know, he's putting himself back down the ladder very, very quickly without he really getting started, if you get me.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I mean, the same could have been said of Anthony Foley when he took on the Munster role, unknown as a head coach in the assistant role all along. And people did ask questions at the time, would he be up to it? Would he be able to deal with the pressures that come with being a head coach? And, you know, sometimes, you know, as a player, you've got to back yourself and take a little bit of a gamble and take that leap of faith. And I think probably coaching is similar in that sense, that you've got to sometimes, an opportunity arises, who knows how long he may have been waiting to get one again, and you just got to trust yourself and know that you feel you're capable of taking on that responsibility. And I think, Leo, I don't think this is something that has just been landed on his doorstep overnight. I think he's been given a lot of time to think about this, and he obviously feels that the time is right and that he can handle the pressure. And he's going for it, and I have to admire him for that.
Okay, listen, great stuff, Reggie. Thanks so much for talking to us. I appreciate it.
No problem. Happy to talk to you.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
Okay, you're very welcome back. Now, I'm delighted to say we have Andrew McNamara and Patrick Mullins in studio with us tonight to talk all things racing. You're both very welcome, lads. Good to see you. Did you watch Golden Horn get beaten today in the Judmont? Patrick?
Yeah, very disappointing. Big surprise.
Was the ground too soft?
Looked like that because, you know, he was beaten, not that he was beaten so far out, but he from so far out he wasn't going to win impressively.
Yeah.
But I thought Sylvester D'Souza was fantastic on the winner, and he's just riding out of his skin at the minute.
He is. Arabian Queen. I backed Arabian Queen at Ascot, I think it was, or Epsom. Anyway, last time she ran.
Goodwood.
Was it Goodwood?
Yeah.
It was Goodwood, sorry. Yeah, you're right. And she ran a good race that day, just got beaten. But I deserted her today at 50-1, and I just thought, nah, too tough. And sure, all Golden Horn, and then talk of Glen Eagles, the ground was too soft. He came out, but yeah, what? Robbie says, I got Aye Skipper. In fairness to Johnny Ward, Johnny Ward was on the show last night, and Johnny bought a horse called Aye Skipper. It had two runs. The first one, it ran a little bit like I did this morning, playing football with knees flying all over the place. And this morning, 9-1, and lo and behold, just look at the screen there, Killarney Aye
Skipper. I'm going to have words with Johnny Ward.
Number 11, which is my lucky number as well.
He was texting me Monday night after Soccer Republic, slagging me off over the analysis on sending off, and now he didn't even give me the tip for a 9-1 shot.
That's probably why.
Okay. What did you have on here?
I had a couple of quid. When Johnny's tips are concerned, you don't go head over heels, Andrew, as you probably know. But look, your last winner as well. I didn't get to back that, which I'd normally follow you to over a cliff, but I was away out of the country at the time. But nice way to bow out.
Was that, yeah? Shark Fair played him and told everyone it would win, that Julie obliged.
Yeah, but Shark tells everyone about all the horses, so.
It was good. It was a good fun day, and Tremor put on a bit of a show for it, made a bit of a deal out of it, so
yeah.
It worked out.
Were you nervous at all because it was the last one? Was it, you know, or did you just go and do your thing and that was it?
No, I wasn't nervous about it. To be honest, I went down thinking, I knew nothing about the horse myself, so.
Yeah.
Being told it had a little chance, but looking up all its previous form, a bit like Johnny's, you couldn't have gone on too much of its previous form. But from the word go, you know, I wasn't worried. It's not an overly big deal. It was a very small race in Tramore, you know. It wasn't going to make any difference to me majorly if it didn't win. But then when it did go and win, the crowd in Tramore went nuts. And it was it was good fun on the day. It wasn't a major deal, but it was good fun.
Yeah, but sure, I was speaking to you last week, and when you said, you know, you were going to make the announcement, and I was thinking, you know, it would be brilliant to go out, you know, your last ever race winning. I mean, that's the dream, isn't it?
It wasn't something I'd massively planned or, you know, thought it would make a major difference. But as it turned out, it did turn out a brilliant day and really enjoyed it, you know, and a good few of my family were down there as well and they got a good kick out of it as well.
Why have you made this decision?
Probably been thinking about it for years, to be honest about it. I've had back trouble for quite a long time and struggled with my weight a bit as well, and probably one affects the other as well, you know. Paddy's here with us. Paddy goes to the races. You'll see him jogging the track every day before he goes racing. I haven't been able to run for about 5 years because my back gets sore from it. And that doesn't help the weight either. So every summer, kind of when things will quieten down, I've done probably something different every summer to try and see, can I start this or do a bit more Pilates or go to a physiologist or do something different. And really it goes on and on and on and it doesn't get a whole lot better. So probably because of that, I don't enjoy racing as much as I used to, or I don't ride as well as I used to. And then the other side of it as well is that I don't want to be a cripple for the rest of my life. So if I get out now, I'm sure I'll probably have a relatively pain-free life. And that. But if I kept going for another 5 years, I'd probably make a crock of myself.
How bad was the pain and how difficult was it to make the weight in the end? Because you're 6 foot one, 6 foot two.
Not quite to 6 foot one, no, I don't think. Just didn't make it.
6 foot.
6 foot, yeah.
But I mean, 6 foot for a jockey is tall. I mean, now Patrick's tall as well, but I mean, it is, must be a considerable challenge though. Has been.
Yeah, it definitely makes making weights harder. You know, I never rode the real lightweights in races. And from when I started, weight was an issue, you know. But that was something, I didn't go straight into racing because I was heavy, you know. I went to college for a while. And then when I did give it a go, I knew weight is always going to be an issue for me, and it has always been an issue. But you know, it wasn't the reason I gave up on things. And in terms of the back pain, then it was very rarely very acutely painful. You know, the odd day you might do something to really annoy it, but
okay,
it was very rarely very bad. But it was always niggling and at me, and a lot of the time I wouldn't have slept because of it.
Patrick, you do a good bit of running, actually, and I want to talk about the jog for jockeys a little bit later on, but I mean, you would enjoy running, and actually, as Andrew said, more often than not, turn up early at a race course and go and jog the track.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm quite tall, so I like to A, get a bit of exercise out of me sitting down, and B, to get out and get a look at the track, see what the ground is like, you know, where I want to be placed on my horse, whether I want to be wide or down the rail, or and That's the main reason. I always used to walk the track, and then I just said I might as well jog it as walk it. And it's mainly really to get a look at the ground, but it's a useful bit of exercise as well.
Do you struggle with the weight?
Do I struggle? No, struggles would be the wrong word. I'm an amateur, so the weights are a lot higher, and I'm obviously very lucky to be able to ride a lot of good horses with my father. So I've kind of set my weight. My minimum weight's about 11.4. Maybe 11.3 or 2 if I really had to, which means I don't have to kill myself.
Okay, well, that's a nice position to be in. I mean, looking at Joseph O'Brien today, and he looked just gaunt. I was saying to the lads joking, he mustn't have eaten for the last week, but he did look just so pale, and he just doesn't look right.
Yeah, well, what Joseph does is extraordinary. But I like to think that doing what I'm doing, I'll be able to ride for a longer period rather than be killing myself. And, you know, it might just, eventually it's probably going to, it makes it harder in the long term, I think.
So things are good in the stable at the moment. Close Hutton and your dad is obviously flying it. It must be pretty special to be a part of your dad's team at this stage, and maybe over the last 3 to 4 years.
It really is. You know, I appreciate it. My father always says that, you know, this won't last forever. It's kind of a perfect storm there at the minute between obviously dad running the show, but you know, having Ruby and Paul as a backup, and then having just the owners there that we have, and you know, our head lads Dick Dowling and Gail Carlisle and the whole team. But it's a perfect storm, and you know, the horses we have going forward this season is it's hugely exciting. I mean, it's scary to think what could happen if everything goes right. What generally happens is that two or three get injured and two or three don't live up to expectations, and you're left with another two or three. But it is a golden era at the minute down in Clough Sutton, and we're going to enjoy every second of it.
Alan, I mean, we spend too much time, let's be honest, we spend too much time following Willie and Ruby in terms of wherever they are.
We love them, we appreciate
them. We do love them, but we said that at Shetland last year. You know, when you look at the horses that are available to Willie's team, you know, just even throw out any pair under, so Votor, Don Poley, like you name it, they have it. And even in terms of the novices as well that are coming through, it's frightening to think what they could do.
Yeah, it's crazy, yeah. And the one thing I kind of, the way Willie carries himself as well as a person, and it's all right talking about the horses because obviously they're the animals doing the business and the quality of them. But when you have Willie training them, who I was even chatting to Patrick earlier, you're talking Alex Ferguson, Brian Cody, whoever you want to name, like he's at that level, that category. Then you have Ruby, right, them as well, who we love. So when you put the whole lot together, it really is scary, and long may it continue because we love watching it.
Is your dad easy to work for? Is he, I mean, obviously we hear, you know, trainers have to be, shall we say, what's the word I'm looking for here? You know, pretty demanding in terms of high standards and what they want. And, you know, how would you find working for him? I know it's father and son, maybe it's different, but how do you find it?
Yeah, no, he's very good. He can blow off steam at times, but particularly when we're schooling horses, it seems to be a psychological thing, I think. But what's great is, you know, he'll roar and shout, and then 5 minutes later, it's finished, it's done. And,
okay, brilliant, yeah.
So, which is important, you know.
To get to that level, though, Hugh, you would have to kind of be like that. Like here, I mentioned Alex Ferguson, they're the hairdryer treatment that everybody knows. So you don't get to that level unless you're kind of so, how would I put it, he has to keep everyone on their toes, I presume. Like, to keep
attention to detail.
And to keep the standards that they have. Every like, you don't just get to that level by just kind of...
Sure.
Getting good horses
and off you go.
Coach. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Andrew, 15-time grade one winning jockey. Give me a highlight. Is there one?
There's a couple, probably.
Newmill
was a brilliant day. And, you know, the kind of... the repercussions of that, you know, people still remember it so long afterwards.
Yeah.
And it was a spectacular performance, you know, real hair-raising performance to ride him on the day. You know, a real front-running two-mile chaser like that is a very exciting thing to be part of. And one I got a brilliant kick out of was Beaver Salmon the day he got up in Leopardstown to beat the Listener.
You know? I was there that day.
And, yeah, that was fantastic, like, because he was kind of a national hero ever before I had anything to do with him. And then to... you know, look done and dusted at the end of his career and come back from a hopeless position to get up and beat the English horse on the line. And then he got an absolutely massive reception coming back in. So I got a real kick out of that one.
I mean, it was a phenomenal reception. The crowd just went mental. I was wondering what that actually felt like to come back in on a horse that, as I say, everybody knows and loves. And maybe that Beaver Salmon, you know, never did the business in Cheltenham, but was so phenomenal around Leopardstown. The fact that it took place there and everyone had such high regard for him, that made it all the bit more special, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, it got an absolutely massive reception. And it probably, you know, if it happened now, it mightn't be such a big thing, but at the time, there wasn't the Willie Mullins dominance. You know, there wasn't six Irish champions going over to Cheltenham expected to win everything.
Sure.
So having a Gold Cup contender probably wasn't as commonplace as it is now for an Irish horse. And that was absolutely huge. About the only time I ever saw a horse get a reception like it was, I think I rode in the race when Big Bucks won his third World Hurdle.
Oh, yeah.
And the cheer he got from the crowd that day was kind of sending shivers down my spine coming back in.
Did you ever get a sense of why Beaver Salmon just didn't do it at Cheltenham? Was he just a horse that didn't particularly like to travel? Was that as simple as that, or is there more to it?
Well, by the time I got to him, he wasn't probably, to be honest about it, good enough to win a Gold Cup. I rode him in a Gold Cup, but he definitely wasn't at that stage. Leopardstown suited him to perfection, I think. The big, more galloping track. Maybe the undulations didn't suit him as well in Cheltenham. Or maybe it was the day he got the fall with Timmy Murphy. You know, maybe that would have been his year. He was a novice that year. He was still a young horse and probably had more speed at that stage. So maybe he could have been a Gold Cup winner had he stood up that day.
Sizing Europe as a horse, personal favourite of mine. I've backed him pretty much since day one. What was he like to ride?
The day he won in Leopardstown, it was...
the Irish Champion Hurdle.
Yeah, that was absolutely fantastic. It was the first time I sat in him. And down the back, I was thinking, this fella's running too keen. He's not giving himself a chance, which means that he's using more energy than he needs to be using for the speed he's going. And I kept thinking, he needs to settle a bit. And then it got to the second last. I thought, geez, he's just going to get home and give him an inch of rain. He was gone. And, you know, it was, I couldn't believe he got to the line so strongly after running too hard the whole race. And he absolutely hammered Hardy Eustace that day. So that was an absolutely brilliant performance. I think I rode him three times afterwards, and he never did that again.
No.
He probably had, you know, something or other amiss with him coming down the hill in Cheltenham in the champion hurdle, in my mind, and on subsequent form. He was definitely going to win. There was no doubt about
flying it.
And then he lost his action. And similarly, I rode him in the Morgiana and Punchestown. He looked a winner and got beaten 20 lengths and something similar then in the Irish champion the following time.
Patrick, can I ask, we've had a few texts in and people on Twitter as well asking if there's any horses to watch out for, and we always kind of get this if we ever have Ruby or, you know, used to be AP or whatever. Is there anything that stands out, first of all, for bumper horses maybe that are coming in the coming year, because obviously that's going to be what you're all about. Anything that stands out for you that's a little bit special?
It's a bit early in the season to know with the bumper horses yet, you know, because they're young horses, so we wouldn't have worked them as such. In the coming weeks, there's a nice mare called Screaming Rose who might run next month. I think I like her. Her dam was actually my first ride in the racetrack. So
okay, Screaming Rose. Yeah,
so I rode.
Showing your age.
Showing my age. Yeah.
So she mark that one down quick.
Yeah.
But as for the bumper horses, it's too early to say at this stage.
Okay. Game over.